hosting another Yes to Life show, looking into what integrative medicine has to offer to those with cancer. This week, the show is all about nutrition and the multitude of ways it can help someone through cancer and cancer treatment. My guest is an extremely experienced nutritionist, Carol Granger. Carol's a registered nutritional therapist with an honours degree in biochemistry and a master's degree in microbiology. She's been a chartered biologist since 1986 and has 2 decades of experience in bioscience research, diagnostics, and medical technology. Her earliest work in nutrition was on the delivery of intravenous nutrition for people with cancer and in chemical interactions between nutrients and drugs. And a growing interest in real nutrition led to her retraining and a career change to nutritional therapy. Carol practices in London at the University of Westminster Polyclinic and in West Sussex and is committed to evidence-based practice, professional regulation and advancing standards in nutritional therapy. She's chair of the Nutritional Therapy Education Commission, which accredits training for the profession, and she's a trustee of the Research Council for Complementary Medicine. Her clinical practice encompasses many areas of chronic ill health, but particularly people affected by cancer. She's also currently undertaking research for a professional doctorate in health sciences at the University of Westminster on the practice of nutritional therapy for people affected by cancer. Last November, she presented some of that research at the Society of Integrative Oncology in the US. So Carol could hardly be better placed to talk about nutrition and integrative medicine for cancer. Carol's speaking today, of course, in a personal capacity. Hi, Carol. Thanks very much for joining me today to talk about the role of nutrition in health, and in particular for those who have cancer.
Hi, it's really nice to be invited to contribute to your programme.
Great. So you're a member of the British Society for Integrative Oncology. It's rather a grand title, but it indicates that you feel strongly that people undergoing treatment for cancer have a lot to gain from the addition of approaches that have been developed within complementary and alternative medicine. This has happened over a period of many decades now. Approaches that support people with, for example, nutrition. In the UK, the concept that nutrition's got anything much to do with recovery from cancer has long been derided. And if you'll excuse my French, one well-known detractor described the whole field as nutri-bollocks. What makes you so convinced of its benefits?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think that if I can add in that I'm also a member of the American Society for Integrative Oncology, or SIO, where they have a much greater appreciation of the role of many modalities, particularly nutrition, but also exercise and mindfulness and so on. I would say that there's a considerable amount of evidence that the right kinds of nutrition, and particularly some other lifestyle interventions, can actually make a difference to people's journey with cancer, whether or not it's people trying to prevent it in the first place or reduce its progression or prevent it coming back. And so as somebody who spent the sort of first 20 years of my professional life working in mainstream science and then retrained as a nutritional therapist, then I'm convinced that the evidence is there, that particularly working with the right sort of nutrition can make a difference. On its own, I don't believe that it's sufficient, but actually in terms of supporting people with their cancer journey, then I think it's actually very important. And I have seen the evidence to show that that's the case.
Great. All right. Well, this show is all about integrative medicine, so I want to focus particularly on the ways in which nutrition can add to what's available in conventional care. Could we start off by looking at the body's nutritional needs at various stages of cancer and cancer treatment? Firstly, in your experience, if you get what would be the ideal scenario of someone ringing you up immediately after they've been diagnosed, what are the things that you look at that stage, and what are you likely to find?
So that's a really good question. And that's the kind of ideal scenario, is that if somebody has just been diagnosed with cancer and they come to me, and this is very typically what happens, and they want to know what can they do to help themselves as they go through what can be really quite a long and tortuous journey of going through diagnosis and staging and treatment and so on. And it's really everything that you can do to make that person as resilient as possible. And that would mean, for example, making sure that they are eating adequate amounts of protein, that their blood sugar balance is good, and particularly that they have a good intake of what we call the micronutrients, which are the vitamins and minerals that are involved in all the body processes. And what I'd like to say at this point is that really when I work with somebody on their nutrition plan, it's very individualized for them. And so it's really important to remember, Robin, that anybody who is thinking about taking nutritional supplements, that you do need to just check that they are completely compatible with any medicines that you're taking and compatible with your situation. So really the information that we're talking about in this call today is a kind of general framework of how nutrition can help, but it's not necessarily right for everybody. And so if you are taking any medicines or if you're on any other kind of treatment, then you do need to just check with a qualified professional before you start taking supplements. And what I would say, a good choice would be obviously a registered nutritional therapist that's had proper training in using supplements alongside medication and alongside other types of treatment. So if I have, for example, somebody that comes to me that's newly diagnosed with stomach cancer, then they're going to have a completely different set of requirements than if it's somebody that's just been diagnosed with prostate cancer or breast cancer, for example. So what I'd be looking for is to try and make them as nutritionally resilient as possible, ideally to get them to eat unprocessed food, to not snack too often, to make sure that they're eating, as I say, good quality protein, and particularly to have a good intake of vitamins and minerals and other phytonutrients that you get from plant food. So that's what I'd be thinking of first.
Mm. Okay, and in terms of the fact that obviously something has brought them to this point in their life where they've been diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
So there's some shortcoming in their immune system. Is there a way in which you assess that?
Yes, I do tests with people depending on their situation. As I say, everybody is different. And I may do tests on their digestive function. I may also, particularly, I often look at somebody's blood sugar balance. I may look at their levels of vitamin D and some other nutrients. It really depends. Everybody is different. But I suppose if I was asked what would be my desert island tests, what would be the tests that I could do if I could only do one, maybe, then I'd want to definitely look at their vitamin D level.
Right.
And if I could have two tests, then I'd probably want to look at their HbA1c, which is a test of how their blood sugar is balanced. So as I say, each person is different, and I'd be looking at different indicators depending on where their particular condition was. I may look at their hormonal turnover, but it also depends where that person is in the journey. You see, when somebody is newly diagnosed, they're at a point of great uncertainty. Yeah. In that they don't know what tests are going to be done from them from the medical point of view. They don't know what their treatment is going to be like, or even if they've been given the treatment plan, there's lots of things going on with them. And so sometimes these tests are more relevant when somebody's completed their treatment. And so there are lots of functional tests that may be done when somebody's completed their treatment, so that you can then look to see what they're to reduce their risks of recurrence.
Mm.
Or if they haven't been able to achieve a curative situation with their treatment, or if they haven't been able to go into remission, then I may use different tests, really depending on what their what their situation is and where the cancer is. So they could involve everything from looking at a hormone turnover test, at how well they break down estrogen, for example. But I may also look at the population of microbes in their intestine. It really depends on where they are in terms of the journey and where their cancer is.
Mm. There's increasing importance being placed, isn't there, on the state of your gut as concerns all chronic disease, really?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, and it is particularly important. But one of the things that I'm often aware of is that if people are heading into chemotherapy, then I wouldn't want them to spend a few hundred pounds on a test on their gut function, knowing that the chemotherapy was going to have an impact on their gut. I'd probably wait until their treatment had completed and then do it. Or if you had somebody that had like a precancerous condition, so if somebody had, for example, precancerous polyps in the gut, then I might think about doing a gastrointestinal profile on them then to see if I could pick up anything that would reduce the risk of that precancerous condition becoming malignant.
Makes complete sense. Okay, so can we now look at preparing someone for the common orthodox treatments, surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy, these kind of things? What can you do to help them get in the best state, if you like, to undergo what are extremely challenging treatments?
It's a good question, Robin, because when people are heading into treatment, then sometimes the last thing that they want to think of is actually eating well. And when people are under stress, sometimes they actually eat really according to their emotions and they don't eat properly. If we think about surgery, for example, when people are heading for surgery, then obviously wound healing is a part of it. But the other thing to think about is blood clotting. And so if you've got somebody that's actually been taking high dose fish oils and they're thinking about having surgery, then I'd actually be screening to see if they've been taking supplements such as high dose garlic or vitamin E or fish oils that might actually affect their clotting profile. So when people come to see me who are heading for surgery, then, and if they have been taking nutritional supplements, then I would just check that they're not taking anything that would affect their blood clotting. That would be one thing to think about. But also in terms of making sure that they have a sufficient protein reserve, so that they are eating good quality protein and so on, that's going to help them heal. And really, depending on where the surgery is, then obviously if it's a sort of keyhole surgery, then that's a different situation. Sometimes when people have major gastrointestinal surgery, then it's often better for them to rest the gut relatively for a short period of time before they go into surgery and not have sort of really large meals and so on. But it really depends on what their sort of where their cancer is and what sort of surgery is planned for them.
Right. And what about going under anaesthetics? Because it's obviously a very unusual situation for the body to encounter, well, for most people. Is it stressful for the body in any way?
It is. I mean, anaesthesia, you know, thank heavens that we do have anaesthesia, but with all of us, I mean, anybody who's had an anaesthetic knows it's quite unbalancing. But these days, the kind of anaesthetics that are used tend to be much better in terms of recovery. A lot of the intravenous anaesthetics give a much smoother ride than the old some of the other treatments that used to be used for anaesthesia. All of these things are a shock to the body. And I think it's as much a case that the person should try and perhaps get help from the emotional point of view as well. So if somebody, particularly if they had a lot of anxiety, then I would suggest that they perhaps see a mindfulness practitioner, that they have the sort of emotional support. So obviously covering all the bases in terms of nutrition would be important. Again, making sure that they have good quality protein, that they're well hydrated, that they're having a good intake of micronutrients, that's vitamins and minerals. But particularly if they have a lot of anxiety, then the anxiety can be helped if they make sure that their blood sugar balance is good. But at the same time, they may also benefit from seeing somebody that specializes either in mindfulness or some other anxiety reduction techniques, and particularly things like if they are yoga practitioners, that's really good. Those sorts of things are very helpful.
Right. So it's interesting. You can approach these things from either end, really, can't you? You can approach them directly from the mind side, but you can also go at them from a nutritional point of view as well. And you're kind of working at two ends of the same thing.
And I think that's what's really nice about integrated medicine, is because basically, you know, we're not just sort of a set of organs walking about inside a skeleton, that we're a whole person.
Right.
And although the specialist who will go in and do the surgery is looking at the gut or the breast or the prostate or the ovary or whatever, but actually that organ doesn't exist in isolation. It exists within a person, and that person has whole body needs in terms of their nutrition, but they also have whole person needs, and particularly their emotional and psychological needs are very important for them to take care of. And good nutrition can actually help people in terms of anxiety, but in many cases, people actually need some additional help as well.
Right. Okay, on to radiotherapy. This is a rather different kettle of fish in terms of a treatment with a very specific challenges of its own. Any help from nutrition here?
Well, I think I'd like to sort of cover radiotherapy and chemotherapy together, because they both have they have profound impact on the body. And some of the concerns that people have when they go through radiotherapy are that the, for example, that the skin might be damaged. And so particularly with radiotherapy, if a person has a good intake of good fats in their diet, that helps with skin resilience. And so what we call essential fatty acids, which are found in things like oily fish, for example, but also in nuts and seeds, then if you have a good intake of those in the body, then that helps skin resilience. And if the skin is resilient, then that would tend to be somewhat more comfortable as they go through radiotherapy. Yeah. Because what many people experience as the side effects of radiotherapy are actually on the skin, as looks like sunburn, feels like sunburn, sometimes is very painful. And really to make sure that, as I say, the fat intake has an impact on skin resilience, so that would be important. Mm. And thinking about chemotherapy as well, in terms of how well people manage with chemotherapy, there are lots of different regimes. I mean, some chemotherapy is just given quite simply as a tablet these days. So some of the drugs are much better tolerated than they used to be. But with all of them, if somebody is particularly eating whole unprocessed food, then that means that they're going to be getting a good broad range of vitamins and minerals, particularly to make sure that they are not overdoing it in terms of protein. You don't want to have a really high protein diet, because protein in very large amounts can stimulate some growth factors which aren't good. But particularly if people can focus on whole unprocessed food, then that would tend to give them a broader range of nutrients. That can be difficult, because when people are going through treatment, as I mentioned earlier, then they can sometimes just end up eating small snacks here and there, because they don't really feel like eating very much, because their appetite's very poor. So it's actually making sure that when they do eat, that everything that they do eat has some nutritional value. Even if it's just some scrambled eggs, that would be better than having, say, toast, for example, which doesn't really have many nutrients in it. So it's actually trying to make every meal count, both during radiotherapy, but particularly during chemotherapy, and where people are having symptoms in the digestive system, to eat light, and that is a sort of a good way of looking at it. Some people don't do very well if they eat a lot of raw food, because even though raw food looks really healthy, if you're going through chemotherapy, that can be sometimes too much of a challenge for the gut, and people end up with a lot of bloating, and that can be because they're simply not able to deal with a very large amount of raw food. So it also has to be tailored.
Right, so the cooking is a sort of pre-digesting process, which helps them out when their gut's under par.
In some cases, yes. I mean, some people do really quite well with raw food. It's really on an individual basis, and it also depends on where the disease is. So if somebody has had stomach cancer and they've had a gastrectomy or a partial gastrectomy, then obviously trying to take in large meals of loads of raw food is actually just going to put them in a really very uncomfortable position. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my first advice would always be to see a qualified, experienced, registered nutritional therapist, a properly qualified practitioner, because that way they can tailor the diet to the individual. In some cases, having a mixture of some raw food and some lightly cooked food is a good combination. Right. And it really, as I say, where somebody has a digestive system disorder, then that's going to be more of a challenge than if somebody has cancer that's in another part of the body. But even then, the chemotherapy will often affect the digestive system, because it tends to affect fast-growing cells.
Mm-hmm. So in what cases or at what point do you change your attention from elements of the diet to actual supplements?
It really depends, because there are some supplements that you would not want to use anywhere near chemotherapy or radiotherapy. And there's some concern in integrated medicine practitioners and in mainstream practitioners that some supplements may interfere with the way that chemotherapy drugs work. And so, for example, it's not really a good idea to be taking very high doses of antioxidants in supplements alongside many chemotherapy regimes and certainly alongside radiotherapy, because they can actually reduce the effectiveness of those treatments. And so with chemotherapy, if you're thinking about having any supplements alongside chemotherapy, then they need to be checked by a competent practitioner who can actually tell you whether or not they're safe. And just to give you a really good example, there's a drug called Velcade, which is used in multiple myeloma. And it's very well documented that green tea interferes with the action of that drug. Mm. And so what you wouldn't want to be doing is having that drug in the hope that it would treat you, and at the same time having green tea that might actually deactivate it. Mm. And so every chemotherapy regime needs to be checked if people want to have supplements alongside them. And in fact, there are some supplements that may increase the side effects of some chemotherapy. Wow. So anthracycline chemotherapy agents, for example, they have a side effect on the heart. And if you take an iron supplement while you're taking anthracyclines, then you can increase the damage to the heart that's caused by them.
Mm. Well, that's the last thing you want to be doing.
Exactly.
So radiotherapy and chemotherapy, they both have quite a few immediate side effects, you know, while they're actually having the treatment, and local side effects, but they both of them have potential long-term side effects as well, the worst of which, of course, can be actually a recurrence of cancer. So again, does nutrition play any part in controlling this scenario in the long term?
I think it's kind of looking at it in two phases, is that when somebody is going through chemotherapy, trying to keep them as well as possible, trying to keep the level of inflammation in their body lower, which is helpful. And that can be in part done by nutrition, particularly making sure that they've got sufficient omega-3s in their diet, or potentially as supplements if that's compatible with that particular chemo. So it's making sure that while they're going through chemo that you are trying to reduce the side effects, but also long term, the picture then is trying to reduce the risk of recurrence of that individual by identifying potential risk factors that they may have that would increase the risk of that cancer coming back. Mm-hmm. And one that is really quite important to think about is insulin, and particularly where people have high levels of insulin, where they have insulin resistance or pre-diabetes or full-blown diabetes, then that in itself is a risk factor for cancer recurrence for many types of cancer. And so somebody's nutrition, the way that they actually eat, their eating pattern and the composition of their meals and so on, and to a certain extent some supplements, can actually have an impact on their risk of developing insulin resistance. And so I would be working with somebody during their treatment and beyond their treatment to make sure that they don't develop insulin resistance, because having high levels of insulin is well documented as a risk for recurrence of many types of cancer. Mm.
All right. Well, it's clear from all the things you've just been saying that there's a lot to know in order to safely integrate the two, the nutritional side and the orthodox treatment.
Yes, I'd say that's the case. And I think that's because even though the regimes are standardized, so the chemotherapy regimes are standardized and they have acronyms like FOLFOX and so on, which is a combination of drugs all put together. So that's standardized, but the patient's never standardized.
Right.
And so their nutrition should really reflect them as an individual. And so if I had two people that came to me on the same day that both had the same cancer and they were both going to have the same treatment, they might actually walk out of the door of my clinic with completely different nutritional programs.
Right.
And they would be based on their blood sugar control, what's called glycemic control. It would be based on their body composition. It would be based on their inflammatory markers or the level of inflammation in their body, and also their personal history and obviously their own nutritional needs and their own nutritional desires as well. So we have to take account of the fact that there are people that are vegetarian, people that are vegan, people that follow religious restrictions in their diets. All of those have an impact. And so to make sure that that person gets a good, well-tailored, evidence-informed nutrition plan can make a difference, and particularly to focus on good blood sugar control and to reduce the level of inflammation in their body. Those are particularly helpful interventions for people at any stage, but particularly when they're just embarking on treatment.
Okay, so a couple of specifics to do with treatment. I'd just like to see if there's anything you've got to say from a nutritional point of view. Hormone therapy, an awful lot of people are on hormone therapy, either for prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, these types. And there are quite a few side effects. People have, some people, it seems very variable. Some people seem to sail through them. Other people have very serious side effects that actually make them want to stop treatment. So,
yes.
Is there anything to help these people?
So if we think first of all about the androgen blocking drugs that are often used in men affected by prostate cancer, these treatments are used long term. They may be used in men who are not going to have surgery, or they may be used in combination with radiotherapy, for example. And because of the way that they block one particular form of testosterone, then that can have an impact on, firstly, it will have an impact on body composition. So generally, men who are put on these androgen blocking drugs may find that their body fat increases and that they have a tendency to lose some muscle tone and lose some muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's blocking the action of testosterone, and testosterone tends to build muscle. So one of the ways that that can be helped in terms of how men experience that and how men deal with that is to make sure that they have, going back to the old thing about blood sugar control, it can make a big difference, because if people are eating a lot of carbohydrate in their diet, then that will tend to make them deposit more body fat. And that is not helpful. It's also not helpful because if they have a high intake of carbohydrate, then they may have a high level of insulin. And what we do know is that insulin is a tumor promoter in prostate cancer and with many others as well. There's actually also some very good research now looking at particular dietary patterns with regard to cancer recurrence or cancer progression. And it does seem as what looks like a more of a Mediterranean-style diet may be helpful. Now, obviously, everybody is different, but that really means having more oily fish, much less red meat, particularly having a good intake of these essential fats, which I mentioned earlier. So in terms of helping somebody to live through that experience of going on hormone therapy, particularly for prostate cancer, then because it does tend to make men lose muscle mass, and gain body fat, and it does increase their risk of developing central fatness, which is around the waist, then that's not a good picture. And particularly the blood sugar control can make a big impact on that. So it's really working with somebody to make sure they're not eating too much carbohydrate, that they're having the right sort of proportions in their meals of carbohydrates. In some cases, they may be eating very little carbohydrate at all, but it depends on the individual. But that can make a big difference. And there are also some other, in terms of encouraging them to exercise. So again, I would refer them to another experienced practitioner for example, resistance training, which can be really helpful in terms of retaining muscle mass.
Okay, well, that's quite a little armory of things you've already laid out for a man with prostate cancer. Is there a similar kind of arsenal for a woman with breast cancer, hormone-driven breast cancer?
Well, that again, that's a long-term journey. So women who are prescribed tamoxifen or letrozole or anastrozole because they've had breast cancer, and in fact, sometimes letrozole is now used in women that have had ovarian cancer, then the impact of these hormone treatments is quite profound. It doesn't just affect the hormone situation, it actually affects their whole metabolic balance as well. And for example, for women going on tamoxifen, there is a tendency for them to gain weight. Right. And what we do know from the research is very clear that women who gain weight after treatment, so particularly postmenopausal women who gain weight after treatment, are increasing their risk of breast cancer recurrence. And therefore, it's a good thing to work with a nutritional therapist, for example, who can help you to prevent that weight gain, because the weight gain is not helpful. Unfortunately, tamoxifen does tend to make women's weight drift up when they're on it. And again, it goes back to good nutritional balancing in terms of not having too much carbohydrate. The other thing that's very helpful in terms of particularly the latest evidence on eating frequency is it does seem that if women who have been affected by breast cancer actually try and have a long fast overnight, so if they try and have 12 hours overnight between their last meal and their breakfast, that's actually associated with a lower risk of breast cancer recurrence and progression. And that, again, is all to do with bringing down the level of insulin in the body. And insulin is this, you know, as I mentioned a few times earlier, it is a tumor promoter. We all produce insulin and we all need some insulin. But if you're producing too much of it, then it is associated with cancer recurrence for many different types of cancer. And if you allow yourself to have a long gap between your evening meal and your breakfast, then that does seem to allow the insulin level to come down. And that's helpful.
Right. Well, this is very important stuff because, of course, many women are taking tamoxifen, say, just to reduce the risk of a recurrence. And, you know, if it simultaneously is making them put on weight and increase their risk, I mean, you could end up with a very counterproductive situation if you don't control that.
Absolutely. And I think it's now something that oncology professionals who work with women with cancer are becoming more aware of this. But I think one other factor that's definitely worth mentioning, which is it comes under the umbrella of a nutritional therapist, and that's to talk about alcohol, because women who've had breast cancer have a number of risk factors for recurrence, and alcohol consumption is one of them. And so one of the reasons why it has an impact is that alcohol also tends to increase weight. But if women are having more than a few drinks a week, then they are significantly increasing their risk of breast cancer coming back. They're increasing the risk of getting it in the first place, but if they are having if they're having a few drinks a week, that's okay. But the latest research suggests that alcohol is a risk factor.
So now I'd like to move on to the next stage, if you like, which is treatment's ended and you want to get people back on the road again. This is definitely an area where nutrition has a lot of strengths, I think. Do you want to say a bit about what you can do to help people then?
Okay, so if we think then about somebody who has completed their treatment and they've obviously, if they've been through chemotherapy or radiotherapy or other types of the immunotherapies, which are increasingly used now, then what can be done to actually help the body to become more resilient? And I think for many people, when they come to the end of their chemo, they actually almost feel like they've been cut adrift because they don't often get much advice. They just get sort of sent away, yes, you're done. We'll see you in 6 months. And I think one of the roles of a nutritional therapist is actually to put them back onto the recovery plan and particularly to think long term about that person's metabolic balance. So again, we're thinking about their glycemic control, making sure that their blood sugar is not going too high. Maybe perhaps at this point I would be doing some tests. I'd be looking at their level, perhaps their level of their IGF-1, which is a marker. Or IGF-1 is a tumor promoter, so I might be looking at that in somebody. I would certainly be wanting to look again at their HbA1c, which is a measure of their how well their blood sugar is balanced. And I may also be looking at their level of micronutrients. So that would be looking at their minerals and some key vitamins just to see where they are on that. I don't generally do those tests while somebody's going through treatment because it's not really a good use of their money, because the chemotherapy and so on stirs up all sorts of things in the body and you want the body to kind of calm down a little bit before you get those tests done. It's a very good question about detoxification, because some people think, well, if I'm having chemotherapy, then I ought to be doing a massive detox to get rid of it. And there's something to be said for making sure that the body is detoxifying effectively. And that's really supporting the liver function and, most importantly, supporting gut function. Because particularly if your gut is not performing well, and for when people have been through chemo, then their gut is often not really in good shape, because chemotherapy tends to have an effect. They may have days of constipation and the days of diarrhea, and that is difficult for them to cope with. So it's trying to restore their gut function, because the gut, not only is it the main route of absorbing our nutrients, but it's also our main route for eliminating everything that we don't need. And so it's making sure that there's a balance of good fiber going into the system, particularly some soluble fiber, which is helpful, and the right sort of fiber that will feed the growth of good microbes in the gut. then that's important. It may be that in some individuals that they need some help, some supplements that may help to support their liver function. But again, it depends on the individual. I'd be looking at their blood tests that they've had done while they've gone through chemotherapy to see what their liver function is like. And if necessary, there may be some things that would be used after treatment to try and help their liver function to return to better shape. But particularly the main focus would be getting the gut into better shape. And that would be, as I say, making sure that there's sufficient soluble fiber, but also particularly to look at some cultured food. So maybe some supplements as well, some probiotic supplements. But I also sometimes use prebiotics in people, and those prebiotics are plant-derived compounds that actually support the growth of good bacteria. So one thing is to put the good bacteria in, and then another thing is to give the good bacteria plenty of things to feed on, and that makes a difference. And I think if I can just add one more thing, and often what people forget is that it's to actually make sure that they're drinking the right sort of fluids as well, which makes an impact. And it may be that some herbal teas are pretty good for helping to calm the digestive system down, stimulate digestion. And some people find that their digestion is really quite impaired, so they don't digest their food very well. And there are some quite smart herbs that could be used as a herbal tea sometimes that will actually stimulate the digestion so that things are working so much better.
So do you work with those herbs yourself, or do you use a herbalist?
Well, I would do, because I have some training in herbal medicine, but I would. There's a restricted range that I would use. They are generally focused on the digestive system, and in some cases they're adequate as a herbal tea. But also there are plenty of herbs that you can use in your food that actually have an impact. So bitter herbs, for example, they actually stimulate digestion. So those are things like rosemary and thyme and rocket and watercress, which you can all use nutritionally, that actually stimulate digestion, and they're very helpful. So where people have got an impaired appetite, they're very helpful, and also where they've got poor digestion, they can be quite helpful.
Great. So it sounds like this point, the end of conventional treatment, is actually a key point for a nutritionist to be involved. It's a great time to consult one. Firstly, from the point of view of there's a lot you can do about getting yourself back on the road again, and doing the best you can to ensure you don't get a recurrence. But also, you referred to the sort of kind of psychological situation of ending all the attention you got from the hospital, and actually there's nobody looking out for you in a way.
So yeah, it's true.
You have somebody who's giving all their attention to your well-being, which is psychologically important.
Yes, I feel that it is. And in my practice, I work with a lot of people that have completed their treatment to try and give them the feeling that they're back in control. And in the last few years, I've been doing some research with nutritional therapists to have a look at the way that they work. And one of the great things that they can do is to actually give people a sense of control over their own health. And I think that is fundamentally important. Is at the end of the day, whatever kind of treatment that you have, doctors are going to give you treatment. Doctors may give you radiotherapy, they may give you chemotherapy, they may give you one of these fancy immunological drugs that are coming along. All those things are done to you, and that's great. But at the end of the day, you can have a really good sense of control and self-empowerment by working on your nutrition. And I think it's my research with nutritional therapists is really showing that this is the case, is that by working with somebody that can empower you, you as the cancer survivor, you as the person who's living with and beyond cancer, can be made to feel that you have so much more control, because what you put in your mouth, what you put in your body, is your decision, and it can make a huge difference to your life on a day-to-day basis, but also long-term. And I think that's one of the great things. If people embrace having a nutrition plan put in place either during their treatment or after, it gives them that wonderful sense of control that they're really doing something for themselves, not just having treatment done to them.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Okay, so I have to ask you about one the big subjects around nutrition, which is, of course, where there's a major divergence of view between the orthodox side and the integrative one, and that's over the role of sugar. So we've got, on the one hand, we've got CR UK are still putting out fresh videos reassuring people that sugar's got nothing to do with the spread of cancer. And at the same time, curiously, within conventional medicine, there's they're developing new types of MRI scans that completely depend on cancer's increased appetite for sugar as a means of actually highlighting the spread of cancer. So a very curious mix. But all through this, integrative practitioners have stuck with the notion, first proposed nearly 100 years ago, that sugar feeds cancer. And this view now probably has got more supporters and more evidence than ever before. So I'd really like to hear what you've got to say about this.
It's a question that I think probably everybody asks me when they come to see me, and it's a question that I often talk about with other practitioners as well. I think it's probably, I think it's more complicated than the simple question of sugar feeds cancer. I mean, as somebody that originally trained as a, my first degree is in biochemistry, so I've seen all of the stuff that's been published on the Warburg effect, and there is really clear evidence that cancer cells love glucose, and they also love another nutrient as well called glutamine. So it's not just a case of sugar is the thing that feeds cancer, but the evidence is there biochemically that cancer cells use up a lot of sugar, and they use a lot of sugar because their mechanism for using it is broken. So the normal cells use sugar in one way, but cancer cells use sugar, they need much more of it because their normal mechanism for using it is broken. And so they can't harvest enough energy from it. They use much more of it. So that is biochemically irrefutable. But it's where that fits in terms of the cancer within a body. Right. And I've looked at both sides of the argument. And if you look at it from the point of view of what Cancer Research UK and many other, what most mainstream oncology practitioners would say is, that even if you cut out the sugar in your diet, that your body is still going to produce sugar because it's going to get it from breaking down the glycogen in your muscles. And it's going to break down the glycogen in your liver, and eventually you're going to get sugar from somewhere. So that's the sort of mainstream view of it, is that even if you said, let's take all the sugar out, your body will still find some.
Right.
And that's a reasonable argument, but there's something much more fundamental than that, is that there's now really strong evidence that insulin is a key player in cancer progression. And in fact, only a matter of a few weeks ago, there was a paper showing that women who were diagnosed with breast cancer, if they had a high level of insulin at the point of diagnosis, they had a greater risk of progression and they did not do so well. They were not as likely to survive that cancer as women that had a lower level of insulin. And one thing that drives up insulin is sugar. And so my take on it is, and my looking at the evidence, is that basically if you have a lot of sugar in your diet, then your insulin is going to be going up high. And if your insulin is going up high, that's not great.
Right. Okay. So it's slightly more complex than a direct relationship then. It's actually one stage removed.
Yeah, it's at least one stage removed. And so the idea that sugar feeds cancer cells is valid in itself. And the Warburg effect has been shown, has been well documented. But the argument of mainstream practitioners is that even if you took the sugar out of your diet, that your body would still just make sugar from something else. And my refuting of that is that if you have a lot of sugar in your diet, you're pushing up your insulin. And if you're pushing up your insulin, then you're giving your body a big level of a tumor promoter. And the evidence is very clear that insulin is involved in the progression of many types of cancer. And the very clear demonstration of that is that if you have people with diabetes, then they do much less well when they develop cancer. And that's because their insulin level is much higher, either because they're injecting it or because their insulin doesn't work and their body has to produce more of it. So that's my take on it. And the evidence, the research evidence supports that. I think that perhaps one of the difficulties is that within mainstream healthcare, and I fully respect the way that they approach treatment and so on, is it would be very difficult for them to tell every cancer patient to stop having any sugar. It's, you know, it's a huge part of the British diet. It's a huge part of the diet of every part of the world almost now. And I think that in some cases that to turn a blind eye to something or to say, oh no, it's not relevant, it's perhaps easier than actually tackling it.
Right. Nice to have an expert opinion on it. And it's obviously not as black and white as the kind of tabloid version. Okay, so can I ask you about one actual symptom of cancer? Because interestingly enough, all the things we've discussed in the way of side effects so far are actually side effects of treatment. And most people actually have very few symptoms from cancer itself until a very late stage when it might be impinging on organs or something like that. One thing that quite a lot of people do suffer from, which is actually a side effect of cancer, is the wasting of muscle and tissue, which is called cachexia. It's extremely hard to counter this, I understand, and it seriously undermines your overall health. What can a nutritionist offer to help here?
Well, again, looking back at the research evidence, there is some evidence that omega-3 fats can be very helpful for maintaining muscle mass, for trying to reduce the rate of muscle loss. And in fact, there's been a couple of small studies where people have had, for example, fish oil supplements, and that's been helpful. And in fact, I remember one particular study where people were being treated for lung cancer, and half the patients were given a fish oil supplement and the other half given a dummy capsule. And they looked at cachexia during that situation. They found that the people on the fish oils actually had less muscle loss. So I would be looking particularly to make sure that that individual had sufficient omega-3s. So omega-3s in food, but also omega-3s as a supplement. And so that would be a particularly good, that would be a good approach. But also to make sure that they have the right sort of protein, but not necessarily to be using very high protein supplements, but particularly to make sure that they've got digestible protein in the diet. That would be helpful. And also I'd be looking at their micronutrient losses as well, because often when people are in that situation, then they're often low in other, they're low in micronutrients, so things like zinc. So I'd be looking at that and supplementing them where necessary to make sure that they are, that they have enough of those as well to maintain their muscle mass.
Okay. One thing I just note is that I think you've mentioned good fats basically in the answer to every single question I've asked you so far. So you obviously set a lot of store by those.
Well, I do, and it's quite interesting because I've been in practice a long time, 20 years as a biomedical scientist, and then doing nutritional therapy since, you know, for the last sort of 12 years. And I remember when I did my original training, everything was supposed to be low fat. And I remember doing low fat myself, you know, low fat for this and low fat for that. And I remember, and now, of course, the evidence is so clear that it's not a case of low fat. What we really need is good fats. And so people should actually be eating not necessarily lots of high fat foods, because that's not always suitable, especially if you've had a cancer in the digestive system and you have a very high fat intake, then it can be difficult to digest. I do have clients that do a fairly high fat diet because they're doing low carb diets, but it's choosing the right fats, it's smart fats really that make a difference.
Okay, well, look, on that note, I think we're going to finish it. It's been really interesting to talk to you. Your experience and your expertise in this field has been very clear in the way that you've dealt with all the questions around cancer in such detail. So I'm absolutely sure that our listeners will be very appreciative of your views on such a controversial subject.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I think that Carol has conveyed clearly that integrative medicine is a discipline of its own, with a wealth of knowledge required to safely and productively combine conventional and complementary methods. As usual, you can find links to resources mentioned in today's show on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk, click on Media Centre, and then on UK Health Radio. I'm hoping to see some of you next Saturday in Brighton, where I'll be hosting our Lifestyle Choices in Cancer seminar and introducing our speakers, Dr. Andre Young-Snell, my guest in last week's show. If you missed it, it's still there on Listen on Demand. Dr. Britt Cordy and Elaine Godley. If you'd like to come but you haven't got yourself a ticket yet, then book right now. Go to events on the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk. Keep an eye out for me, Robin Daly, and for the charity Yes to Life on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, over the coming week. Thanks very much for listening today. I hope you found it useful and interesting, and that you'll be able to join me again next week. Goodbye.